Hello! Welcome to episode 3 of Agitated Podcast. How are you today? Go ahead. You can take a moment to answer. We're going to now jump into our... Yeah, I didn't give you very long. Now, as usual, we're going to start things off with what is agitating us at the moment. And to start us off...
It's me, Shelly. I got something.
Shelly. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I got some stuff that's agitating me. Let's go back a bit to last month. Everyone probably remembers after like a pretty strong showing of pressure on President Biden to take a stand on releasing the patents, the intellectual property on the vaccines and therapeutics related to COVID-19 so that they could be manufactured anywhere else in the world and the distribution level would greatly increase and it would become, a lot easier for people to access vaccinations and therapeutics. So they finally did that. And this was a campaign promise that he made when he was running against Trump. And then after he came into office, it was just like cricket silence. So, you know, people started to... say stuff, and then they finally did put out a statement saying that they support this. Well, I think a lot of people thought that meant that that's going to happen. And so I just want to talk about why that's pretty meaningless and why we need to be like escalating our pressure, because what is actually happening is the EU... The European Union has a lot of influence over this process with the WTO and the nations that are kind of in charge of the trade agreements or rolling back of them that would allow this to happen. And so Angela Merkel, who was the Chancellor of Germany, she came out and basically said she doesn't support the waivers. And French President Macron, did I say his name right? Macron.
I think so.
Macron.
Thank you.
If only you guys could see Jessica's face right now.
My soft chin doesn't translate.
Yeah, so he's expected to follow suit. And so these are leaders who are influenced by the European Union. And the European Union has this, like, they call it their non-political executive arm, the European Commission. This arm of the EU has met since March of 2020 to now. They have met with pharmaceutical corporation lobbyists 140 times. And they have met with a group that, advocates for the, patent waivers for the vaccines one time. So it's pretty clear.
Yeah, sounds totally non-political.
right. Non-political arm. And so there's tons of, money and lobbying and effort being put forth by Big Pharma to influence the EU to make sure that this doesn't happen, because it requires consensus. The WTO requires all of these leaders to be on the same page. So, people need to know this and know that we need to keep putting pressure on Biden to not just take this symbolic stand, but to fight for this and to, use the immense power, that the United States has at the negotiating table. But the problem is, that sounds good. He is also the largest. He's the recipient of the largest amount of pharma cash of any United States politician in history. So I don't want to get like too conspiratorial, but it feels very controlled opposition vibes to me, where like it's a safe position for him to take when he knows that there are other leaders who are going to ensure that that doesn't happen. So it's maddening because this is global scale now. So like, what can we even really do about that? But this is outrageous. This is absolutely revolting, and people are going to die because of this, putting profit over people, which is exactly what's happening here.
And in this country, we have a really poor history of like having a global perspective and a sense that we actually need to hold our government accountable in that way. I mean, partly because there's a lot that our government does to us that keeps us busy, maybe you could say. But I think that that is, if anything is American exceptionalism, it is our sense that, you know, we operate on our own and our interests are above all else. And you know, everyday Americans really fall into that too. So I'm glad you're raising
it. Isn't it a good reminder to not take these symbolic gestures at face value and think we've solved the problem or like, you know, that the administration is actually doing anything? Because making this happen, as you said, like takes a lot of proactive work, which we're not doing. Yet we're, you know, that administration claimed all this glory for, you know, waiving these patents. So, and how often does this happen, right? Where we are faced with these, you know, really, really important issues. We get a statement from a politician, we think, and then if you're not directly affected, right, you move on and continue with your life.
And it's not in the news. It fell out of the news cycle. So I think there are just a lot of people who think that that was kind of the end of that and that everything is going to move forward in that way. And that is not true. I did see yesterday, I was really, really glad to see in New York City, there was a protest that seemed not small. And they went to the EU embassy in New York, I think it was ACT UP New York, and I don't remember who else was part of it. They went from Pfizer headquarters to the EU embassy, which I guess was walking distance, which was convenient for this action. And I just think we need to do more of that, and we need to be lifting up the people who are doing that and making sure everybody sees that these actions are happening. But yeah, it's a lot. It's already hard in this country to affect change in our own country. And then when something is happening on this global scale, we just feel so powerless, and we kind of are. There's not a lot that we can do other than, you know, getting out in the streets, finding strategic ways to, you know, get people to see what's happening.
Well, I think talking about it, I mean, that's not enough. And that's a source of agitation, right? That we on all this, that we always need to figure out how to act powerfully in a system that tells us we have power, but where we don't really. My family lived for a couple of years in Europe when I was pretty little, so I think it would be, you know, I'd have much more understanding now. But, you know, one of the things, even though it seems small, just making sure that the rest of the world understands that we actually care and that we are not our government, I think is really important. And
absolutely.
And just to flag, I think sometimes, I mean, I definitely fall into this all the time, but we... when we say we and we're talking about like our government that does things that absolutely we don't support, like we need to somewhat check our language there and make sure that we're saying very clearly, you know, who it is that is responsible, not to pass the buck, because, you know, it's our tax dollars. If we were to withdraw our consent in a powerful way, we could bring it all down. But it gets confusing when we're like, we attacked blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, we didn't. We didn't have any say over that whatsoever. That's a little bit of an aside, but it's something that I think would help us to hold that clarity when we're speaking about what our government does and our actions.
Not to completely relieve us of accountability to pressure our...
Right,
you know,
exactly.
This terrible government. I mean, we still have a lot of power that we are not taking advantage of. Like, Is the general strike off the table for the summer? Like, you know, we have a lot of things at our disposal to, like, step up together collectively and be like, mm-hmm.
I also want to kind of veer off, but also kind of touch back on something Caitlin was talking about and how, you know, we in this country, in the United States, we don't really generally keep a very healthy global perspective, if we have one at all. So I want to talk about, so today is Friday. Yesterday, Thursday, was a tweet from Representative Ted Lieu, who, you know, is considered a pretty progressive Democrat. And he made a tweet that was pretty shocking, and he got, you know, ratioed, but... I just want to talk about it for a second, and I'm going to read it. I'm going to read a response and then read his reply to that. So bear with me. This was about the announcement that we're going to distribute 80 million vaccines out of the United States to other parts of the world, which, you know, first I want to name that's not very many vaccines when we're talking about the scale of the human population in the world and this virus. But we are doing that. And Ted Lieu said, he's a California representative. Do you know what area he represents?
Southern California. I can't remember the district. Valley.
I strongly disagree with the Biden administration on their global vaccine rollout. We should help our allies first, instead of letting a third party decide where vaccines should go. Since there are not enough vaccines, should we help India or Iran? We should help India first. Then somebody...
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's just take a second to respond to that.
Okay.
Damn.
Fuck people whose government we don't agree with. Let's just let them die. That is U.S. foreign policy position number one.
And yeah, we've just underlined how the we is separate than governments, right?
Right.
Like, so fuck those people with the governments we don't agree with.
Right. So then somebody responds back to him, says, I normally respect you, but this is a rough take. Since when is humanitarian aid tied to whether or not a country's government is an enemy or an ally of the United States? The U.S. probably shouldn't have a say in how the vaccines we provide are distributed.
So to be fair, the answer to his question is, we do that all the time.
Right. Right.
Since when? Since forever. Since,
right.
Well, I think it was a rhetorical, meant rhetorically, yeah. But, you know.
I know.
Why should? Like, yeah. Maybe would be a more accurate.
We don't always get this opportunity, right, when they say the quiet part loud to, like, be able to articulate and push back on it, because we don't even get that totally. Opportunity, right? So he did provide that opportunity. So he responds. I can't believe how much worse it got from here. He says, we lost that moral high ground the moment we decided to prioritize Americans first when it came to vaccines. Now we need to make sure that American interests are protected first.
I think one thing that's important to remember here is that Ted Lieu is one of the congresspeople who's sort of known for, he manages his own Twitter account. This is not a staff person most likely speaking on his behalf, who sort of accidentally is off in some direction. Ted Lieu uses Twitter a lot, and that's sort of partly why he's more known there, because he's not passing that to someone else. He runs his account himself.
Interesting.
Well, I was just going to say, when I saw the tweet first happen, because I was, like, you know, on the ground floor, like I often am as a frequent Twitter user, I noticed he was, like, basically kind of responding back to everyone in real time, just, like, not somebody, it's just not, like, the behavior that you would expect from a congressperson. Like, he, you know, just kind of, like, very, he wasn't stopping to think, right? And he was engaging, like, low follower accounts that were challenging him. And I was like, okay, dude.
Such a weird way to go about it. So it's like you're blaming Trump, kind of, and being like, well, he's the one who was the jerk first, to put it most crassly. So therefore, now, when I am showing that we don't really give a shit about people in any kind of equal way, it's fine.
Yeah, so I'm going to double down. Trump did it first. I mean, the whole Trump is the bar now, because Trump is the bar now. So anytime as long as you're slightly better than Trump, like, that's really the effect that his presidency had on, in general, but on the Democratic Party, is, like, the bar was already low, and now it's just dropped to the floor. And as long as you are not Trump, basically, you can do anything, even if it's very Trump-like.
And honestly, mostly what people mean by that is his demeanor, right? I think actually what people mean by being better than Trump is, like,
Politer,
right? Being able to speak concisely and articulate things in a grounded way that is professional and not threatening to people's emotions, you know? That's actually, it's not even about, is your policy better? Are you ending policies that Trump started? And inciting violence in a crowd in front of you is something, right? Like, not to diminish, like, that's violent, that rhetoric.
Yeah, but even when it comes down to, like, Trump, like, openly grabbing pussies, like, oh, well, right. Biden does it too. He just doesn't talk about it. You know what I mean?
Like, exactly. So it's really just about sort of their vibe.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, so yeah, Ted Lieu did not use any exclamation points. So it's like, oh, okay. This sounds way better.
Yuck.
Okay. So my agitation this week is deeply agitating in like one of the most visceral, foundational ways that anything agitates me. So this is news that's been ongoing for a little while, but I just kind of got into the details of all of it and learned a little bit more and wanted to talk about the abortion ban in Texas. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, we've all heard of fucking him, signed into law a barbaric ban on abortions at 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. So Texas already has an extremely subpar reproductive health system. We know this. It's like notoriously hard to procure reproductive health care in Texas, right? But now it's essentially a complete ban starting at 6 weeks with no exceptions. You know, you often hear sort of even anti-choice people talking about exceptions for, you know, rape and incest, and that even very low bar is not included here. A lot of people would call this like a heartbeat bill, right? This happens in the South a lot. We've seen a dozen states have passed heartbeat bills, which basically means as soon as there's any cardiac activity in the fetus, that is the point at which you can not terminate the pregnancy. I'm just going to read a bit from The Guardian. Unlike those measures, the Texas version absolves the state from enforcing the law. Instead, it allows any private citizen the extraordinary authority to sue an abortion provider. They do not need to be connected to the patient or even reside in the same state, opening up the floodgates of harassment and frivolous civil lawsuits that could shut down clinics statewide.
Whoa.
So,
and they almost have zero clinics to begin with, right? I mean, isn't there like just a handful? You have to drive like hundreds of miles.
Just a handful. That's right. It's a huge state and there's a couple clinics. And in addition to a million other things, like because of the build up to this too, all the past things that they've done to limit reproductive freedom, abortion providers are like extremely scared of Texas, right? They're scared to be there. Like it's just chilling for anyone who's trying to make change because they can get fucking arrested. So, okay. In addition to that, any individual, again, connected or not in the state, whatever, can sue anyone also who aids and abets abortion care or who intends to help an abortion patient. So anyone who knows you or not can sue you for driving your friend to get an abortion.
Wow.
Like, this is Handmaid's Tale right here.
Totally.
And so this says those who sue can collect a minimum of $10,000 if they're successful.
Wait a minute. What's the harm? What is the harm for this to this party that is suing personally? I don't understand the – I mean,
so they're basically like – they're basically setting up a system where it's like, you know,
you can get paid out for –
like you're like a bounty hunter.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So – anyone can sue fucking anyone for helping their, and that includes like lending your friend money to get an abortion because it's very expensive and obviously not covered in like health insurance. So this law is super broadly written, which is another piece of why this is so such, I mean, it is so bad. I don't even know if I have the words to talk about how scary this is.
Handmaid's Tale is a very accurate way to put it. And
yeah.
Not at all hyperbole.
Yes. So again, the people can target not just like abortion clinics and staff and people who are helping people procure abortions, but also anyone that volunteers or donates to an abortion fund or activist organizations. So this is coming directly from the executive director of a reproductive rights advocacy group, Avow Texas. And she also makes a very good point that domestic violence and rape crisis counselors who offer guidance, family members who lend money to abortion patients, a friend who gives a ride to an appointment, or even someone that provides an address to a clinic could also face lawsuits.
Jesus Christ.
You could be sued for $10,000 for giving someone an address where they can get an abortion. And so, you know, in addition to that, her point about abusers is such an important one, because what this means is that someone who is in an abusive situation and becomes pregnant and needs an abortion can be taken the fuck down by their abuser. Like this, the potential for abuse here is, I don't even know.
Not to mention that at 6 weeks, very few people would even know that they were pregnant. It's so.
Right.
Yeah, so nobody knows unless you're actually trying, in which case you're probably wanting your kid. It's when you're not that you don't really figure that out that early.
I will say right? Just like to get personal for a second. I have, my wife and I have been trying to have a baby for 4 years. We've been doing IVF. I very much like want to have a baby. And as someone who is trying to bring a baby into the world, you need access to abortion. It's not safe to be pregnant without access to abortion. It's so fundamentally healthcare for everyone. In order to live in the world, you have to be able to have access to abortion, right? It's not just about the very valid reasons for having an abortion, like you don't want to have a baby or any other fucking reason you want, which are 100% you're right. But also, it's not even just about people who don't want to get pregnant. It's about people who do want to get pregnant or people who,
right, who are having, can't get pregnant. Issue, it's, yeah,
all of us, mm-hmm, right? We all need access to abortion for health of our communities. So it's so disturbing. And so Texas abortion laws, which now includes a 24-hour pre-abortion sonogram, I'm sure you've seen this. There's these places, these pregnancy care centers who are, you know, will offer you guidance. So it's these people, they give this sonogram. So you have to like see this clump of cells and, you know, they try to talk you out of it and give you all of this horrible propaganda about why you shouldn't have an abortion. You have to endure all of that before you can do this. And it also limits judicial bypass, which is where, like, if you're a minor and you don't want your parents to know you're having an abortion, you know, a judge can circumvent that so that you can do that.
Which is basically making sure that the process of getting an abortion, if you are able to even do that, is traumatic. Which, like, having had an abortion, it absolutely does not need to be traumatic at all. For some people it is. Right. Some people, but this is basically being like, we're going to do everything we can to try and make sure that this is a traumatic experience for you.
And even in less, you know, scary states, but still scary states like Indiana, where I lived, I was a social worker for pregnant and parenting teens. And I learned something really fucked up, and then learned it for myself on a personal level. But so these crisis pregnancy centers, CPCs, they are, you know, basically extremely well funded through, like, you know, churchy fundraising. And they get an ultrasound machine, and there are all these volunteers who work there, and they are not healthcare professionals at all. But if you are in Indiana, and I'm sure this is true in a lot of other states, in order to get pregnancy Medicaid, so that you can see a doctor, you have to have a proof of pregnancy, which is normally something you acquire from a doctor. It's not, you know, you can't take your pee test in there. And the only way to get that for free is through a crisis pregnancy center. So, and when you go to these, they proselytize you. They all fawn over you and like talk about how it's just, you know, they show you the picture. I've gone through the process myself. Cause I got, my first pregnancy was in Indiana, which it didn't work out, but that I had to go through that process later. Anyway, it feels extremely unconstitutional to be forced to be proselytized in order to get something that is supposed to be your right in the state that you're living in. So in order to get Medicaid, you have to get your proof of pregnancy through this like very religious institution. And so all of my clients, when I was a social worker, some of them weren't sure what they wanted to do, but they did want to go see a doctor first. Or they weren't even sure if they were, they thought they might be, you know, it's just like, you know, that they were just early in that process before they'd made their decision. And so I, you know, it was awful knowing that I had to put them through this process to get them connected to the resources that they need. And yeah, this is, it's just like outrageous. But then, yeah, I had to go through it myself. And then I moved to California where I got pregnant again. This time it did work out and I have an almost 6-year-old. I called California Medicaid and I assumed they were going to need me to get a proof of pregnancy. And they're like, no, we believe you. And I was like, oh, wow. So what, you know, like, nobody's going to lie about being pregnant to go see, you know, an OBGYN. Yeah, like, what's, no, there's no, nobody has any
vehicle to be like, we need you to stop off here first.
Exactly.
And get propagandized and harassed.
And so that's when it like really all clicked into place for me, when I was like treated with dignity and like I, you know, was definitely what I said I was when I called them, you know, they're like, no, you just get insurance. And they just gave it to me right then and there. And then I was able to see a doctor. So I just wanted to tell that story because you brought up the crisis pregnancy centers. And I feel like that's relevant.
No, everywhere. And access to pregnancy tests, which is, you know, still an issue here. The similar thing happened to me when I was a teenager, and went to the, you know, the health department, and they said, go to this clinic for free pregnancy tests. And these, you know, and at 16, I'm sitting there waiting for my pregnancy test to develop. And before I even get a result, they hand me this, like, very lifelike silicone heavy fetus, you know, that's very much more advanced, months more advanced than I would have been, you know what I mean? And you can feel it. It has the weight. So I'm holding on to this, like, very baby like. It's not the lump of cells inside me, but it's very much that traumatizing experience where then even if it didn't have to be traumatic for you, you know?
Yeah.
It totally will be.
Yep. Right. Yeah. Well, I can just imagine if that had happened to me. I mean, I wasn't 16, so 16-year-old having, you know, all the worry and everything that you're, you know, just stress of the situation. And, you know, but I'm an adult when I got my abortion, and I was very clear on what I wanted. It wasn't, you know, I wasn't having any sort of turmoil about it. But if somebody had handed me a fucking silicone baby, I would have been in a different headspace.
Yeah, and not a headspace where you make a different choice.
No,
but a headspace where you're traumatized about the choice you're going to make.
Feel like shit.
And also, like, being directed from a public agency that should absolutely, at the bare minimum, get providing condoms and pregnancy tests. Mm-hmm. To be directed to a place that would shame you is just, like, so sick. And
Yep.
As they're gutting, like, sex education, you know, it's just like,
oh my God, my sex education was like how to insert a tampon. Like, swear to God, like, there was, like, nothing deeper. Like, I'm glad we could talk about vaginas in a class for a second, but, like, that had nothing to do with, like, procreation or, like, being safe. Or,
Millie,
like,
is not very old, so we need to, you know, like, this isn't some kind of, like, archaic, like, well,
Then. No, I'm 31. Like, this didn't happen a long time ago. This was a second ago. I'm sure the sex tapes haven't changed much, you know, for the kids going through it
and
now.
And you didn't say, and just to make sure, this was all in Arizona. Just
Northern Arizona. And, like, you, Shelley, had a very, very different experience going to California where, you know, there wasn't any shame. Services were readily available. You know, you felt support from strangers just because they were able to hand you a test and not, you know what I mean? So,
right. Which is just so, like, low bar. I mean, that's, can appreciate it here, but also at the same time, like, we should not be in the position of being like, oh, so grateful that California is this special. You know, it's like, that's just a standard that is, like, the bare minimum.
Yeah. I grew up in California. I never had an experience like that. It was quite accessible, actually, but there was a crisis pregnancy center in my town right by the high school. Mm-hmm. There was the high school McDonald's crisis pregnancy center. And I didn't know what that was until I learned what that was, you know?
Yeah. I feel like because it is so different in different parts of the country, it's so helpful to hear this because I grew up in New Mexico and my experience there, you know, but there was a minute where I thought I was pregnant when I was younger and I went in and got a test and it was, you know, just like it would be in California. So I just think it's so important. And I had to stop watching Handmaid's Tale because I was like, this feels so horrifying. And I just want to underscore it. I know we already said it, but it's just like, can we just let it sink in that, like, that show and how it feels like it's so extreme is just like the reality for women who are living in the majority of this country. Maybe population wise, there's more people in, like, New York and California that, you know, overall, I don't know the numbers, but it's a huge amount.
The other part of this that really agitates me is that whenever something happens in a southern state like Texas that is terrible for the people of Texas, you inevitably have a bunch of liberals saying, well, they deserved it. They brought this upon themselves. It's Texas.
They voted for this governor.
Come on. They voted for this. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's talk about this for a second. Because Texas, as we all fucking know, has one of the most developed voter suppression systems in the entire country. Mm-hmm. It's, like, notorious. And there's a 30-day deadline for in-person voter registration, the most restrictive law in the country. There's, like, one one drop box for ballots in each county. I mean, they have done everything in their power to make sure that the people's voices are not heard. So it is absolutely infuriating to hear people conflate the leadership of Texas who are making these decisions with the people who live there who aren't being heard and don't represent what's happening as a result of this.
These are the very same people who will, out of one side of their mouth, go on and on about how terrible voter suppression is. They, you know, will also talk about, you know, like the black vote being the backbone of the Democratic Party when, mm-hmm. you know, over half of mm-hmm. black Americans live in these states and they are being suppressed. It's just so fucking incoherent and spiteful and nasty and it enrages me to no end. And there are so many people risking their lives in ways that people who live in safe blue states, like the activism that happens in those states is, I'm sorry, so much more hardcore than what we're doing in California mm-hmm. and New York. And there is absolutely like no respect for that. There's no respect for, you know, the people who are marginalized. And I even see people saying, well, they should just move. And I'm like, fuck you. First of all, super expensive. Second of all, when your whole family has been living in a place for, you know, like.
Yeah, what if you care about the place?
Yeah, exactly.
What if you're like, indigenous?
Right.
Yes,
right.
Yeah.
And it's the exact same argument that people use against them. If you don't like America, leave.
Right.
That's a bullshit. Right. That's bullshit.
Yeah.
Well, and I you're think that the exact people same thing. Get swept. I think that they're, you know, the outrage is super real and legit because the solidarity sucks and that's unacceptable. I think that also there are probably people who listen to this podcast who are much more caring, you know, caring people who do have solidarity in their hearts and compassion who get swept into that discussion as well, you know, and it is something that we all need to really remember. And it goes back to, you know, the piece that Shelley talked about of like how bad we are as Americans about remembering the rest of the world. And, you know, the people of Iran should not just be subjected to astronomical COVID, you know, because their government is at war with us. Like, it comes down to, at the core of it, we need to care about the people. We need to support them. And if nothing else, when we think about it, don't just put "you deserve this" thoughts out there because people are at the mercy of, you know, fascist rulers. What kind of exactly. fucking movement are we going to be able to build if that's the mindset that we get into? So when you see that, if it comes up in your conversation, if you find yourself falling into that, you know, check yourself and then say something in the conversation. It doesn't have to be like a big shaming thing of like, how dare you? I care about the people of Texas and you don't, you know, that doesn't help anything. But, you know, to just remember that that's all part of divide and conquer. And we're not helping ourselves. We're not going to build power from a place of blaming people for being subjected to horror. I'm glad you brought all this up. My agitation, I actually, we talked about this before, but I just want to, you know, name for everybody. What I wanted to talk about was the news that 215 children, you know, some as young as 3 years old, were found, the remains were found at a mass grave of a former boarding school for Indigenous children in British Columbia.
But a secret mass grave, right? Like, yeah. It wasn't a graveyard, it was right. a school that they buried children under.
Yeah, thank you. And when we were talking about it ahead of time, we realized that we really want to do a separate show. And what the bonus episode that we did on Palestine kind of came out of, it was originally going to be an agitation. And then we realized there was just more that we wanted to say, and we wanted to all talk about it. And we also wanted to bring forth, you know, some education and some background and some context. I will just say that, you know, one of the things that's been disappointing and is part of the reality of this in seeing how it's been talked about is, one, mostly I am seeing it come forward and being even discussed in that week when it came out from Indigenous people, Native people, not a lot of white folks talking about it. I think in our communities, in white communities, it's something that's not known. It's something that's not noticed. It's glossed over. I'm not saying that I think that people were like, oh, I don't care about that, you know, but it's like it hasn't even come forward enough to be on a lot of people's radars, which is part of why it needs some more time than just like the 5 minutes or so that we do on each thing. And then the other piece is a real misunderstanding of how recent this is and how these boarding schools, first of all, calling them boarding schools gives you a very different impression than what they were. They were, you know, children were kidnapped from their families, stolen and forced. They were prisons for children and they were propaganda indoctrination. You know, it was part of the genocide policies of the United States and Canada. That they were basically like re-education, violent re-education schools where children were, you know, brutally and violently stripped of their culture and relationships. And that was the intent.
And demeaned and meant to feel shame surrounding their culture and heritage, this like complete whitewashing.
Yeah, and obviously abused physically, I'm sure sexually also, because that's always part of these things. And the point was, it was all part of the policy of ethnic cleansing of, you know, the United States and Canada towards Indigenous people. And really recently, I mean, some of these schools were not closed until the 1990s. And so the sense, even when it was talked about in a lot of, you know, news media, mainstream media covered the story, but it was discussed in a way that made it seem like this is some ancient history. And, you know, we're all so sad. And it's like, you know, the relatives of these children are alive now, siblings, you know, there are tons of Native people whose parents were in boarding schools and even, you know, people who are alive who had to participate in those, though. So, you know, it's just it's so heavy that I was having trouble kind of figuring out how to come at it in a shorter way. So we decided that we're going to do a show about it soon and talk more about it. But in the meantime, we'll put some resources in the show notes so that people can at least learn, especially if this isn't something that you heard about or the way you heard about it is kind of what I've been describing as was the mainstream discourse, which was wholly inadequate.
Welcome to Agitated Podcast's Twitter Roundup, where we synthesize some of the weirdest, funniest, and most agitating Twitter phenomena that's gone down over the past week. We're going to start with a verified account called StopAntisemitism.org. This account has over 20,000 followers and purports to, quote, expose antisemitism regardless of source. Sounds legit, right? Well, this account, whose number one target of obsession is Representative Ilhan Omar, started retweeting small pro-Palestinian accounts and accusing them of anti-Semitism, in at least one case succeeding in riling up enough harassment to get an account suspended. For what? Saying, quote, anti-Semitism is unacceptable and does not have a place within any authentic liberation movement. I embrace Judaism and all anti-Zionist Jews who are in principled solidarity with Palestine. But not before they tagged his employer and demanded he be fired. So the good detectives of Twitter began to look into who was behind this account, and they did not disappoint. Turns out it's a woman named Liora Reznichenko, who goes by the handle Jewish Chick on both Twitter and Parler. She's an avid Trump supporter and participated in the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. She even addressed Marjorie Taylor Greene's comments comparing mask mandates to the Holocaust by saying she has a point. And it turns out her organization is astroturfed by the Milstein Foundation, who has deep ties to AIPAC, the huge right-wing, pro-Israel, pro-Netanyahu lobby that has been lining the pockets of both U.S. parties in order to have continued support for Israel's apartheid against the Palestinian people. This is a case study in how well-funded right-wing interests will take the very real issue of anti-Semitism and use bad faith arguments to silence those who disagree with the actions of a government that even the United Nations has finally admitted is committing genocide.
And on that note, I also want to talk about Eve Fartlow. It's been a few weeks since it all went down, but when I proposed this initially, I realized my co-hosts weren't really quite sure what happened there, so maybe you aren't either. Eve Barlow is a Scottish music journalist, an outspoken Zionist, who began tweeting the most deranged and bad faith commentary as the violence was ramping up against Palestinians. And she became a minor character for leftist anti-Zionist Twitter to make fun of, the favorite nickname being Eve Fartlow. But she didn't want to be a minor character, apparently. And in late May, penned an article in Tablet magazine called The Social Media Pogrom. Pogrom, if you didn't know, is a synonym of genocide. Her case? Being called Eve Fartlow. She went on to describe her treatment on Twitter as, quote, digital waterboarding and online lynching. The absurdity of her claims resulted in Eve Fartlow being a top trend for over 24 hours, even drawing anti-Zionist Jewish actor Seth Rogen to tweet a fart emoji at her. We aren't sure if the Fartlow effect is what she was going for, and for now she has faded out of the news, despite going on Fox last week to seek sympathy for this violent campaign that has been waged against her. All I have to say to that is... And that's the Twitter roundup. Thanks for listening. And once again, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free.
Okay, so now we're going to turn to our interview with Daniel, who's somebody that we have worked with for many years, and we're really excited to talk with and bring him to the show.
Dr. Daniel Lee became the first Black member of the Culver City Council in its over 100-year history when he was elected in 2018. He now serves as Vice Mayor of Culver City, which is part of Los Angeles. He currently works as Project Manager at the James Lawson Institute. He is a veteran of the U.S. Air Force and California Air National Guard. Daniel has a master's degree in social welfare from UCLA and a doctorate in social work from USC. We've known him for years as a member of the board of directors of Move to Amend, and earlier this year, he ran for state senate in California in a special election in a race where he came in second place.
Okay, so Daniel, thanks for being here with us. We've been excited to talk to you and have you as one of our first guests. So our first question is just, what's agitating you these days?
I hate to be like a broken record, but for me, it's bipartisanship. And the desire of the current Democratic president, Joe Biden, to reach bipartisanship with Nazis. And I don't know if agitated is strong enough a word. The fact that the Republicans, many of whom have ties to the folks who were breaking into the Capitol on January 6th, were even allowed to have a vote is sort of ludicrous to me. It's like, oh yeah, we supported some of these insurrectionists who were basically trying to take over the Capitol and even, you know, had plans to kill Mike Pence, which is something that people in the Republican Party should object to. But, you know, beyond January 6th, it's just this notion of bipartisanship for everything. There is this space right now for Democrats to actually do something, something substantive. I feel like every time Republicans are elected, they change the structure of government or taxation forever. And the Democrats come and then they, like, you know, they shine up like the front of the car, or like, you know, they get it detailed, you know.
One headlight, they shine. That's it.
Yeah. We wanted to ask you, because in many ways, you straddle two political worlds. You're a radical who believes in real systems change and liberation and revolution, not to put words in your mouth, but we know you pretty well. You're in the movement. And you're also an elected official trying to make concrete change for your community. And you've worked within the Democratic Party to do so and run as a Democrat. So we wanted to talk about how you see the current moment as it relates to organizing and making change in these two spheres and how that works for you.
In my run for state Senate, I got support from Sunrise Movement, Democratic Socialist, a lot of groups that are made up of primarily young people who haven't been as involved in the political process, but chose to get involved first from an activist viewpoint. Many of them took the same path that a lot of really fervent Bernie folks did. They were on the outside. They only joined the Democratic Party, you know, to try to make larger change. After, you know, that didn't happen, they were like, well, we'll see what Bernie does, or we'll see if we can push them here or there. I know a number of them personally who actually went to the California Democratic Party convention, and they were basically live tweeting it. And they're like, why am I at this convention with all of these recorded, like, you know, pat myself on the back conversations from Democrats? What is this about? And a lot of the older delegates who, for some reason, the older delegates who are more radical, who actually vote for other people besides Democrats in many different elections, I don't know why they're still a part of the Democratic Party, because what I've seen happen with these new delegates is the same thing that happens to them, but it seems like it's happened to them seven times. Like, you right. know, with the whole notion of bipartisanship, it's like, you know, Charlie Brown and Lucy, it's like, come on, kick the football. You're gonna push Biden to the left and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, don't get me wrong, there are some things that Biden is talking about that he just would not have spoken about without right. all the work from activists and organizers over the last few years. But there's this false equivalency that's still at play where we got to listen to both sides. And it's like, do we got to listen to both sides? Because, you know, one side is woman hating, does not like ethnic minorities unless they're self-hating, is homophobic and transphobic, openly doesn't care about poor people. And I'm not talking about Trump. I'm talking about the Republicans, you know, Matt Gaetz, Marjorie Taylor Greene, they're his antecedents. And they say the same stuff because they know it works. So this notion of bipartisanship and this notion that as a Democrat, I can work through these same structures and enact change is something that I butt heads against a lot of the Democrats that I know here in California. Part of my campaign was basically, this is the vision that California wants you to believe, and this is actual California. And the vision that California wants you to believe is like, we have Democrats in the governorship, in the assembly, in the state Senate, and that's why things are going so well. The reality is things are not going well. The economy is doing well for great, you know, large companies, but in places around the state, in small cities and in large places like Los Angeles, the income inequality that was in place before the pandemic is worse. People got what, tops maybe three or four checks between Trump and Biden, and they're surviving, but they're surviving a disaster movie, basically. You know, it's like, yeah, we don't have much, but we do have ramen. And it's like, people don't become their best person if they're eating ramen every day. And that's what a lot of people are doing. And don't get me wrong, I actually like top ramen. I eat it from time to time. That should be a choice. It's not a choice for people in California.
We want ramen and roses too.
I want to press you a little bit further, though, and I totally hear you about this farce that, you know, we need bipartisan support to get anything done. But I've also been experiencing, you know, this really troublesome notion of, you know, Democrats claiming to be such an alternative when really their centrist stances are so similar to the right that, you know, it's hard to see any line at all, actually, now. So I guess my question would be, what traction do you see us having as you are, you know, an elected official running under the Democratic Party, or who has run as a Democrat? How do we have play within that?
Well, there is some possibility in California. One of the things that I've been very honest with about my election is that there were a lot of internal problems in the context of organizing that made us, you know, come in second, but, you know, not get as many votes as we should. But basically what I'm saying is there's an appetite for that alternative that the Democratic Party is, for the most part, not providing. And there are a number of races and a number of people here in California that I'm supporting next year for 2022 that I think are that alternative. The problem is they're in the same party with people who, frankly, in California in like 1984 would have been Republicans. Like, there's no way. Like, they would have been Republicans. There's a significant portion of the Democratic Party that would be Republican if we just rolled back the clock. People always, you know, when you post a meme about how far our politics have shifted to the right, there are always party loyalists who are like, no, that's not true. We got people like AOC and Bernie who would never be in the party in the past. And it's like, yeah, those are tokens. Well, and I was going to say, I appreciate some of the things that have been pushed. There are a lot of things about the Green New Deal that are closer to reality because people have been talking about it so much. Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman, you know, made a press conference about a bill that they have that's basically around nationalizing utilities. That's not a conversation we really could have had a while ago. But if we just stay in that conversation phase, then, you know, we feel like we're doing something. And the hurt that people have and the, like, really, really difficult time that families are having in particular just continues to get worse. And the fact that the fight for 15 seems like it's fading in the context of reality is ludicrous. You know, the last time the federal minimum wage was raised was over a decade ago.
And with Biden winning and the Democrats taking Congress, supposedly, if you go back, you know, what, 4-8 years even in the fight for 15, which has been going on for that long. So there's the question of, is 15 adequate? No. But if we put that aside, it's like we should be at the moment now where we win it. And Biden is taking it off the table. So
not just that, we should be at the moment where Biden pushes for it. You know, there are different ways to exercise the office of the presidency, you know, and I think the most effective presidents, whether I agree with them or not, use their pulpit not just to affect voters and to bring them out and have them put pressure on representatives, but to be the leader of their party and say, hey, this is what we're doing. And if Biden said, this is what we're doing.
Well, that's what I mean. Like by winning, it's like it should be implemented. By the under the strategy of the progressive Democrats of, okay, we need to get people in and elect them to office and then have a critical mass. And we need activists on the outside to push the agenda, which blah, blah, blah. Everyone's been doing all that. It's like now is the point where the strategy should be effective and should work. And yes, exactly. Biden, who supposedly believes in a $15, you know, we've successfully gotten the politicians who are in the positions to actually implement the policy to agree that the policy is what they believe. And yet here we are and it's not happening.
Well, and specifically, like, not just about the minimum wage, but like there have been a lot of analyses around the strategies for eliminating student debt. And there's a great deal that the president can do with an executive order, but he chooses not to, you know. And then there was his, I guess, PR push around trying to get a global corporate tax rate, you know, to try to eliminate tax havens. And there's corporate pushback. And he's like, oh, well, I guess I need to listen to business more. And it's like, nah, you need to listen to the people who have died. Like, I mean, 600,000 people have died in the U.S. in the last year. And that's like 775,000 less than died in the flu of 1918, 1919, and like, I think 200 times the number of people that died on 9/11. Like, this is a disaster, and it's a disaster that has been inequitably distributed. You know, the people on the bottom, the people who make the least, the people who are more likely to be Black, brown, immigrant, or women have died at higher rates and have been affected at higher rates and have long haul COVID symptoms and the whole jazz. And our recovery is like, well, let's make sure that businesses can survive, which is great if those businesses actually employ people and actually pay them a wage that, you know, is a living wage, but that's just not the case. It's so bipartisanship. Yeah, it's some bullshit.
So Daniel, and you don't need to box yourself into your life as an elected official, but tell us more about some of the life events that have radicalized you.
For me, that's a little bit of a hard question because, like, I moved in December into a place by myself for the first time in a very, very long time, and I'm much, much, much happier. But as a result, I came across a lot of writing that I did when I was young, and I was like, wow, that kid's a freaking communist.
I came out of the womb a communist.
It was very, very surprising. And I used to joke when I was in my 20s, I was like, oh, I was much more radical when I was like 11. But it's true. And it's weird. There are a few things that sort of crystallized my thinking. One, and I'm definitely going to age myself here, which I don't mind at all. But when I was in middle school, we had a mock election, and it was the 92 election. And in my middle school, Bush won. I voted for Clinton. Of course, my political analysis wasn't super complex at the time, so voting for Clinton made a whole lot of sense. But then I went home and I told my mom, and I told her that, oh, Bush won in our school. And she was like, oh, that makes sense. I'm probably going to vote for President Bush. And I was just like, Mom, we're poor and we're Black. You are not voting for President Bush. And it's not like we had had a conversation about it before. It's not like, you know, we had had some complex, like, analysis. But I was just like, no, you're not. You're not doing that. And this is from a mother who, for me and my older sister, not for my older brothers, but every summer, if we didn't go to NYSP, the National Youth Sports Program, which happened at Tuskegee University, and we were at home in Pensacola, Florida, she would give us assignments. So a lot of the people that, like, people have been discovering on social media for like the last 20 years, me and my sister wrote book reports about, you know, it's like, oh yeah, Mary McLeod Bethune, and, you know, oh yeah, this guy invented, like, the streetlight, and oh yeah, Muslims invented, you know, like, and I think the knowledge of those things, and specifically, my mom used to buy me a lot of poetry books, because I used to write a lot of poetry as a kid, and a lot of the stuff that Langston Hughes wrote in particular was pretty scathing, and I think a lot of that stuff sank in for me. From a racial perspective, when I was a sixth grader, one of the things that crystallized my sort of racial consciousness, one, my girlfriend Tina was Vietnamese, so I was like, okay, all this shit that these little kids are talking about Asian people needs to stop. But then also, one of the people that I thought was one of the cool kids at my school was doing some type of weird thing with his hair, and I was like, oh, let me see if I can do that. And then his response was like, oh wow, I've never seen a nigger do that. And I was like, oh, what? Oh, we're not friends anymore. I mean, it took me a long time to process, but I was like, okay, does he not know that is bad? And an experience I had after my freshman year of college, my college experience in undergrad was, it was good, but the financial part was difficult. Pretty much worked full-time in undergrad as well, as master's and doctorate, but like, I still didn't make enough money to pay off all of my bill to USC in the first year. So I went home and I worked in a factory for like about 3 or 4 months before I went back to my second year. And there was literally one person who was close to my age. So we got along and we talked a lot. And he said some of the same stuff, like, as like a 19, 20 year old. And he was like, oh, is it bad for me to say that? And I was like, no one's ever told you, / no one's ever punched you in your fucking face. it was incredibly surprising. But then also for me, like, there are a couple instances, both when I was in high school and when I was in college. Like, when I was in high school, my French honors teacher usually let us just talk, because our junior year we had a bomb threat every other day. So a lot of times, in order to allow us time to process, you would allow us to just talk about issues that are going on in the school. And a lot of my female friends in the school were just talking about how they basically been minorly sexually assaulted in the hallways since they came to high school. And it was a surprise to me. There's a lot of like grabbing and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, wow. I had a similar conversation in my 20s with my female friends around being catcalled, because for me, I'm just like, logically, that's not gonna work. This woman's not gonna.
There is a certain level where it is weird how that doesn't ever penetrate.
So it's like, well, maybe a guy does this once or twice, but then he realizes it doesn't work and he just stops. And like every friend I had across the board was like, they've been catcalled. And I was like, that's crazy.
Maybe I'll the goal is not to actually pick up the woman, but just to make her feel uncomfortable.
Yeah. The last experience I'll reference, when I was in film school, I took a motion picture camera class with a lot of different folks. I knew everybody. We all got along. A couple years later, I took an advanced motion picture camera class. And someone in my class like looked sort of vaguely not familiar. And then she walked up to me and she was like, Daniel. And I was like, hey. Not remembering anything at all. And then she was like, it's Shauna. It's Shauna. And she was like, formerly Sean. And I was like, oh. And at the time, you know, I didn't know anything about trans identity at all, but I knew, okay, this person is Shauna. Got it. Remember you now. How you doing, Shauna? Blah, blah, blah. She immediately went into a short diatribe about just her experience, but she told me after she transitioned, almost all of her friends wouldn't talk to her. Her family alienated her. And, you know, I didn't know a whole lot about trans identity at that point, but she seemed like the same person to me. So I was confused and I was angry, but I didn't really know, like, how to put any of the pieces together. But, you know, that's just a few instances of, like, what radicalized me on a number of different levels. Because I think sometimes we just talk about the economics, but a lot of times, you know, what is portrayed as radical is just recognizing other people's identity and worth, and, you know, thinking that that should be at least as equal as that of a white man. But, you know, that's a couple instances for me.
Thank you for sharing all of that, Daniel. The next question is kind of in the same vein and maybe crosses over with some of the answers you already gave in the last question. But who would you say are some of your main political influences or people that radicalized you, whether that's in your life or, you know, political figures past and present?
Most of my greatest influences are not political. And like my greatest influencers are my grandmother and my mom. My grandmother was her own like individual mutual aid society. She never talked about mutual aid. She never gave me a pamphlet. But you know, she would take care of, basically everyone in our very large family, but then she would check, and this is in rural Alabama, but then she would check on all the elderly people, like who are older than her. You know, this is started when she was in her late 50s into her 70s. But then she would also like go to the jail or the prison to visit people that, you know, their elderly or infirm parents couldn't visit. And they weren't like in our family, you know, she was just taking care of them. And she always also grew large fields of corn and greens and watermelon and all sorts of vegetables that she let other people take if they needed to eat. And I thought, yeah, that's the way you're supposed to do things. My mom did the same thing. I gotta admit, I didn't like it as much when she did it. Cause growing up, we were usually in like a 3-bedroom house with a room for my mom, a room for my sister, and then 3 dudes in the other room, which wasn't ideal for me, especially once puberty started. But then my mom would always invite other people to live with us, like my cousins from Alabama, because Florida had a better educational system, believe it or not, at the time. And then we would also always be driving other people to work, and I was like, we gotta have a 5-person car and there are 5 people in it. Why are we adding 2 more people? This is dumb, Mom. Stop doing this stuff. I didn't appreciate it at the time, but you know, my mom learned from my grandma. My biggest political influence, and I think it goes deeper into what's been projected about him versus his actual reality, is still Martin Luther King Jr. My grandmother was a huge fan. So I was a huge fan. And there is this audio documentary, King from Montgomery to the Mountaintop, that would play during his birthday season over and over again, every time when I grew up. So I grew up sort of idolizing him. I even wanted to be a preacher for most of my early life. But then, you know, once I got into the later King and his speech at Riverside Church, the Beyond Vietnam speech, you know, that was really like, yeah, he tied it all together. Because, you know, he talked about basically internationalism without saying it. And, you know, there are a lot of different times where he directly referenced democratic socialism. There are a lot of times where he referenced socialism. There are a lot of times where, you know, he talked about uplifting women, even though he was cheating on his wife. And then there are, like, you know, later reports about him and, you know, some of the queer folks like A. Philip Randolph and other folks, you know, being bros and him advocating for their side. He was a complicated person like we all are, but much more radical. And there was a point where, you know, people were pushing the autobiography of Malcolm X on me. Spike Lee's Malcolm X came out, which is a fantastic movie. And I came to think of them sort of in the same light, because by the time they died, their politics were very similar. Their politics were really based on economic equality as well as racial equality and gender equality. And, you know, they've really been my biggest guides.
We'll put a link to those speeches in the description.
Yeah, and that's a really good transition into what I was going to ask you, which is I feel really honored that you invited me to come do the James Lawson Institute, which you organize, which was really an impactful time for me. And so I wanted to ask, you have a long history with practicing and studying and teaching direct action and civil disobedience. So in case anyone listening doesn't know, I'm wondering if you can define these things, talk about them, and tell us how you see the role of direct action and civil disobedience in making change.
Yeah, I mean, I think direct action and civil disobedience are essential. Part of the mission of the James Lawson Institute is to help and encourage people to put more nonviolent techniques into their campaigns. When it comes to the direct action, I think of it more as like, okay, we tried advocating, we tried petitioning, we tried sending letters, let's break something. And, you know, maybe not literally break, but like, you know, maybe like stop the trucks or the trains from moving, you know, do something that is actually disruptive. I think civil disobedience is similar, but a lot of times for me, civil disobedience is centered around objecting to something that is within the law that you think is morally wrong. Like, one of the things that immediately popped to mind when you started talking is, you know, when we went to the airport after in LA, after the travel bans came down, you know, it's obviously a piece of policy that was motivated by racism and wanting to, you know, whip up the crowd that had bought Trump into office. But it was obviously just morally wrong. You know, whereas, unfortunately, you still can't get a lot of people to come out, you know, when an unarmed person of color, a black person in particular, gets shot, because they're like, well, what about this, and what about this, and what about that? When there's, you know, something as explicit and obviously aimed at a specific group like the travel ban, you can get up and have a bunch of people say, this is not right. But I think both are essential, not only to fight against policies that you think are unjust, which I still think is more civil disobedience, but to advocate for better policies, which I think falls more in the line of direct action. And I know there are a lot of indigenous groups in particular who, in our current media environment, even though a lot of us know them well, haven't really been highlighted as much in terms of the direct actions that they've been taking, particularly the First Nations people in Canada, who have been successfully, you know, rolling out direct actions to say, no, this is our land, and you are not going to come in with this, that, or you're going to at least talk to us because we are First Nations and you are a nation. A lot of that's been very inspiring. One of the things that we emphasize at the Institute is people fall into this trap where they do the same thing over and over again. They do a march and they do a protest, or they do petitions, a march and a protest, and that's it. And things never escalate. And they rely primarily on folks on the inside to have a change of heart. For me, I think that's ludicrous. Most politicians, their heart doesn't really come into play. The hearts of their supporters do come into play, and that's when it matters to them. But I think we could use a lot more direct action and civil disobedience across a host of issues. I was happy to see the Sunrise Movement at the White House today. I think they need to get more provocative. We need more direct action. We need more civil disobedience because there's just so much that's unjust in our society. And I think it can be hard to say, okay, I'm willing to put my body on the line, but where should it go? Because there's just so much that's wrong.
I appreciate you making the distinction between like direct action and civil disobedience, because I think it's not just semantics. It's helpful to kind of understand that those are a little bit different. And also, as you were talking, I was just thinking about how, you know, as organizers, one of the things that is hard is motivating and helping people to actually think that they can do something about it, instead of like that at the end of the day, it's going to be up to somebody else and you just need to convince them. And I think part of what's so powerful in my experience, what's been really powerful about doing civil disobedience is what it does for me too, is realizing here's an opportunity for me to actually act in the world the way I believe, instead of just sort of mentally wringing my hands about the fact that the world isn't the way that I want it to be, you know?
Yeah, and I think it's empowering for people to be a part of civil disobedience. I think it even empowers them to do some of the things that they are more experts at that aren't civil disobedience. It's like, oh, I was a part of this crew, but I'm a good lawyer, or I'm a good graphic designer, so I'm also going to do this, and I'm going to keep things going and get other people in. It also builds community. I mean, like, one of the reasons, like, a lot of the mutual aid networks that have popped up in COVID, that popped up, you know, around Hurricane Sandy, that popped up in various iterations, were so easy to pop up is they already had built-in communities of people who had, you know, been arrested together, or at least run from the cops together, or, you know, unarrested people together. All things which I've done with some folks. And, you know, when you can say, hey, remember that time we unarrested our friends from the cops?
Yeah, yeah. Being in the foxhole together is a bond.
Oh my gosh, doesn't just go away.
But I would love to take a second, if you can, Daniel, to sort of like tease out what is civil disobedience? Because I think people often have sort of a superficial idea in their mind that it's just like showing up for a march. And, you know, we want to like impress that it's much bigger and takes many forms. So if you wouldn't mind just talking about that a little bit.
Sure. There's a book on nonviolent techniques, which I think could range between direct action and civil disobedience. And of course, not everybody makes the distinction I'm making right now. But I think in terms of civil disobedience, you know, even if you think of like what Thoreau and the Transcendentalist and all those folks, like they took themselves out of society more or less, or they advocated for taking yourself out of the processes in society that, you know, you think are unjust. And I think, you know, that's really the basic part of it. You know, a lot of places like my city, Culver City, even though it was a whole hard push before I was on the council here, you know, we passed sanctuary city laws. That's a form of civil disobedience, but it's something that didn't happen because of politicians. It happened, you know, because there were demonstrations. It happened because, you know, people created mutual defense networks immediately after Trump was elected, and, you know, had these crews that would just show up and provide a human barrier at people's houses when ICE showed up, you know, people being ready to be there and say, nah, this is not right, and being willing to get arrested for that. It's really about taking an action against, in my definition, a specific policy that you think is unjust. And, you know, that can take a variety of forms. A number of years ago, shortly after Occupy, you know, I participated in the West Coast port shutdown. And I think, you know, that's less government related, but it's a direct action, which could also be phrased as civil disobedience. You know, we basically shut down the port so trucks couldn't come in or out. In many places, with the support of drivers, I think it's best to have support of
whoever you're working with or advocating with, and some places not. But, you know, that helped the drivers themselves in their negotiations. Unfortunately, the drivers, just like people who work for part-time services like Uber and Lyft, are still being exploited to some degree because corporations have so much power and they passed laws that basically superseded the efforts that we had, you know, because California has a proposition system. But civil disobedience is really, you know, seeing an injustice and saying I'm not going to stand for it and doing something about it, something to disrupt that injustice to some degree. Civil disobedience isn't just saying, oh, I think that's wrong. That's having an opinion. That's, you know, we're free to do that at any point in time. What is often infringed upon is our right to assemble. Our right to free speech is something that, you know, presidents and law enforcement are like, yeah, you say what you got to say. Spread it anywhere you want. The media only listens to us anyway. One of the things that we see in Los Angeles is, you know, oftentimes our sheriff, who is presiding over a department where it's been documented that there are gangs within the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, some that target youth of color in particular, give themselves little tattoos and badges for killing people, and then harass the families of the people that they've killed. You know, that sheriff is within the confines of the law and protected by the law. But, you know, a lot of us are saying, you know, no more, and basically disrupting and saying, hey, you know, this isn't the way things should be.
Yeah, I appreciate this conversation about, you know, basically like how we can act more powerfully, you know, and remembering that we do have power, and having opinion is not that. It's not the same as that at all. So kind of in that vein, like, what do you think is some of the most impactful work that's happening in the movement right now? What are you inspired by that others are doing and that, you know, is leveraging power best?
I think there's a lot that we need to do in the movement at the moment. As it always happens when there's a Democratic president elected, especially with the Democratic Congress and a barely Democratic Senate, a lot of folks become complacent, even folks who think that they are more radical or progressive. There's some good work being done locally here. One of the very odd races that I've supported already is the race of Kenneth Mejia for LA City Controller. And, you know, Kenneth is very connected to a group that's K-Town for All, which advocates for unhoused residents, but also to Black Lives Matter. And he's been putting the LA city government on blast about their promises and their great words around police reform and the fact that they raised the LAPD budget by $47 million this year, and that the money that they cut from the budget last year, which was around $150 million, $90 million of that went to basically sweep homeless encampments. And a lot of the things that we've spoken about, even Measure J. Measure J was a measure that passed in LA County last year, which said that 10% of the county budget needs to go for prevention and rehabilitation, restorative justice. But in a practical sense, it's not being put in place. So there are some advocates that are working to actually do that. What I do appreciate, you know, is the people like Sunrise, the people like Extinction Rebellion. I forget the group that Jackie Fielder and NorCal is working with, but they're putting their bodies on the line to stop oil pipelines. I'm working with a group here now that's really, we're organizing an action in July around healthcare. Because in California, you know, we have super majorities in the assembly and the state senate. We have a Democratic governor. Somehow,
that is some crazy agitating shit. How we do not have Medicare for all in this fucking state.
Exactly. Well, and part of the problem for me in terms of the activists and the organizers is that they're speaking to other activists and organizers, or they're speaking to elected officials, and that's it. Like, they're not speaking to the people who actually have the pain, the people whose lives could be bettered. So we're trying to organize a series of actions here in LA, hopefully San Diego, and maybe the Bay, that really focus on the people who are actually being hurt. and the people who could potentially benefit, because, you know, it's not going to happen unless everybody actually demands it. And, you know, at this point, there are a lot of movements that I support, like the movement for Medicare for All, that everybody from the outside sees as old white people. And in California, as a state, has no racial majority. That should not be the case. I myself know many people of color who are in the movement. Yet when there is a platform that's larger than our self-organized spaces or DSA or, you know, Healthcare for All LA or whatever our independent groups are, those go to like white people. That goes to this old white doctor. You know, even when like nurses and all of the support staff are highly female and highly people of color. It's encouraging that, like, I pushed a whole lot of Healthcare for All people and say, hey, we need to do something around the people who are actually being impacted. But overall, I'm not that optimistic at the moment about the work that is being done. I am repeatedly inspired by the work of Indigenous communities, both here in the U.S. and in Canada. But overall, you know, we need a shot in the arm, and I'm hoping, as things open up safely and as people are more and more vaccinated, that we can have those shows of force that say, no, we didn't go away. We still care. And we're going to take steps and direct action to show you how much we do to move our policies forward. Because on policing in particular, I mean, I'm particularly frustrated. You might have seen me talk about it on Facebook, but my council agreed to certain reforms last year. My city manager and the staff in my city delayed and delayed and delayed and delayed. So we had a huge discussion around police reform this year. We came to some decisions and some agreements, and they were the same things that I suggested and got approval for last year. It's incredibly frustrating, and it really just sort of exemplifies how much more we need pressure from the outside to not only have people say, oh yeah, we're going to do this or vote for this, but to actually make it come through to fruition. Like, we have $1.4 million in our little city's budget for mobile crisis response, unarmed response, and I'm happy about that. LA City's still dragging its feet. We are actually lapping LA City when it comes to good policy. But it's not enough. It's not a reduction. Like, our budget increased a little bit as well. And that's just not what should happen in our current context. There are a lot of people who are like, oh, the crime rate is increased and this is increased and that is increased. Well, when poverty increases, that's what happens. And every Canada paid their residents $2,000 a month. And we paid people, you know, a max of maybe $6,000 for, you know, 14 months of a pandemic.
And it's crazy is, if you have an understanding of an agenda that you're trying to move forward, it's like when Democrats are in power is exactly when you push, because what Republicans don't give a fuck. Trump doesn't give a fuck if you're protesting him. There's no pressure that you can actually meaningfully apply when the people who have the power to make the decisions literally don't care, and they fully understand what they're doing, and they aren't going, you turning out in the streets makes no difference. But suppose, you know, this is the time where if their base is agitating, then they have to, you know, then they're in a position where they need to respond. They being the Democrats. It kills me that strategy isn't understood.
well, yeah. And on that point, like, you know, Democrats in California have moved a little. I'm actually very surprised to see a lot of the stuff that I talked about during my campaign moving forward, like universal preschool and forgiving rent and mortgages and utilities in California during the pandemic. But some of that stuff is moving forward because our governor is being recalled. And, you know, if he wasn't being recalled, I'm not sure. Like, maybe we get like he released a list of like 15 fairly good things that he should have done 4 years ago. And it's like, oh yeah, great. You don't want to lose this election. But what can you do when the stakes aren't this high to show that you actually care, that isn't just a photo op?
All right. So congratulations, doctor. We're all very proud of you for earning your doctorate in social work. We've known you through the whole process, and it's really great to see you achieve that goal. And I'm also a social worker. I have a bachelor's, though, which is very different in terms of what you can do with it.
But I've been seeing a lot of discourse around social work and the role of social workers. And so I think it would be good to kind of talk about that a little bit. And I know for me, I'm not practicing right now, but I may again someday. But I do struggle, you know, with, I got radicalized through while I was in school. And so my understanding of the systems that I was an arm of, you know, started to crystallize, and capitalism and racism and all these things were like, I started to make all those connections and, you know, and started to like hate the system. So I guess my question is, for one, I don't really know. I mean, we've talked about this here and there, but I don't really know what your plans are and how you're going to use your degree. So I'm curious about that. And then I wonder if you feel that tension about, you know, this system and what we can do within it. I don't know. This is, if we're in a fundamentally oppressive system and we're working within it, like, I just want to know how that feels for you.
When it comes to social work, like, social work is a microcosm of all of the good things about movements and the bad things about movements. The first social workers were simultaneously direct practitioners and community organizers. But they were also like racist white ladies.
Jane Addams.
Yeah. Who pathologized the people that they were trying to help. You know, they were like, well, these are the lesser classes and they need our help. We're doing good. But, you know, it was with a whole lot of judgment and a whole lot of assumptions about like people's abilities to do anything. But the community organizing part in a lot of social work schools has been lost. I focused in my master's program on community organizing and nonprofit management. In my doctorate program, I focused on income inequality and generational poverty. But I think a lot of the people who have been doing that work, you know, for years, for decades, are the people who really have the best information. And to some degree, social work sort of straddles the line of you really need to be a professional and or people who are not professionals, but who are more connected to their community might be more effective. You know, like, I think there are a lot of social work programs, and this was mine. I was the only Black male in my cohort at UCLA. And then in my cohort at USC, I think we had about 15 people of color. In our final semester by design, we all took our final thesis class together with this one African-American female professor. Because every time we brought up anything, especially last year when the uprisings were happening, white people would complain. Mm-hmm. Why are we talking about this? And of course, a lot of us would be, well, what population do you want to work with and where do you live? And a lot of people are in places that are dominated by people of color and they don't want to talk about race. A lot of people are in places that are dominated by people who, you know, are genderqueer in some way, and they don't want to talk about gender, you know, and it's like, you can't do that and actually be effective. Or you can, but you might actually harm the people that you're trying to help. And I think, you know, it's very weird to me that, like, well, one, my colleagues know I'm a socialist now, even though I think of myself as more of an anarchist, and that my master's and doctorate are in social work. I'm like, oh, well. It harkens back to the question from the start. Like, I feel like I've always been sort of people-centered, and I was always sort of like, why don't we just distribute resources better if people don't have what they need? Like, it doesn't make logical sense to me. Like, and I didn't ever call it anything. But I think there's potential power in social work, and a lot of departments are taking a different look. And frankly, a lot of my friends who are psychologists and psychiatrists have admitted that from a practical perspective, you know, when they're talking to clients, they basically use social work techniques, you know, like they do a lot of CBT, but they really focus on establishing a rapport with the client and meeting the person where they are and looking at the person and environment, which are, you know, social work first semester type of things. And I think that's very essential for organizing work as well. I think to some degree, macro social work is sort of like working in local government or working as a community organizer. You know, you really got to have connections to people. You have to be able to listen to people, and you have to work with people rather than delegating. And a lot of social work schools are becoming more radical because there is this push to have a non-lethal response, but from people who can deal with a lot of different issues and who've been in a lot of different places. But like there's a drive to have, you know, cultural competency in social work when it's done the right way. And there's a drive to, you know, work with people and have them define their goals. And I think that makes sense from a community perspective and from an even larger perspective where we're trying to organize with people nationally. It's like, what do we really want to do and how can we get there together?
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and giving us such good stuff.
We will put how to get a hold, or not how to get a hold of, but Daniel's personal phone number
in the description.
Yeah, we'll put Daniel's cell phone on there. He loves calls. That's the best way to reach him, especially early in the morning.
We will
make it so that if you want to follow where Daniel's at, you can find him.
Great. Thanks for having me.
All right, thank you for tuning in. You can sign up for our email list so you can get a notification whenever a new episode drops. Sign up to get notified at agitatedpodcast.com. And we want to hear what's agitating you, so let us know at agitatedpodcast.com. Click the menu item titled What's Agitating You. You can write in or record a message that we may play in the future on an episode. You can also leave us your feedback under the Contact Us section of the website.
Don't forget, we've got stickers. If you'd like one, drop us a line with your address through any of our social media channels or the website. And speaking of social media, we'd love to connect with you there. You can find us at Agitated Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
Please don't forget to subscribe and rate us 5 stars on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you tune into podcasts. And if you would, leave a positive review on iTunes. It really helps the algorithm bump our podcast and new people find us on our show.
And please share us with your friends. Podcasts like ours grow through word of mouth. So thank you for your support. And a big thanks to Jason and Radical Guide for helping us produce this show, and Alfonso for helping us with promotion. See you next time.